I know about my history.
Okay, today is Monday, September 20th, 2010. This is Fidencio Marbella with the Melrose Park Public Library in Illinois. Also present is Margaret Flanagan, reference librarian here at Melrose Park. Today we will be speaking with Mr. Michael Malpere. Michael served in the U.S. Navy from 1943 through 1946 aboard the USS Lamar, APA 47. This interview is being conducted for the Veterans History Project at the Library of Congress. Let's go ahead and get started here. Mike, why don't you tell us when and where you were born and a little bit about growing up?
I was born in Melrose Park, January 1st, 1919. I lived at 906 North 24th Avenue, just off of Lake Street.
Okay. Can you tell us a little bit about your family?
My father's name was Tony Malpere. They called him Donato, I believe. And my mother's name was Millie Iasco. And her parents were born in Italy. And that was in the 1860s, I believe. And then they came to this country. And they lived at 1108 North 23rd Avenue, right across from the Mount Carmel Church. In fact, my parents, we were five children, and we were orphaned very early in life. My father passed away when I was only seven, and my mother passed away 3 years later. We lived with different relatives. My brother Vito and I, we lived with my grandparents, my mother's parents, okay, at 1108 North 24th, or 23rd, and my brother Tony and my sister Jojo, she lived with my aunt Tressa, who lived at 124 North 24th Avenue. And my oldest sister, I believe she was kind of on her own. She wasn't that old. She was working, and but I don't remember where she worked. And so we lived with, my grandparents were quite old at that time, and so we finally moved upstairs, where my uncle Tony, who was a chief of police of Melrose Park, we lived with my Aunt Bertha and him and his children for quite a number of years. And he was very thankful for us. We went to Proviso. We and my brother Vito and I were football players on the football team. And they used to call us the Malpere Twins. And my brother Vito was better than I was, but we were very good. In fact, we went through a football game one year without being defeated by any of the schools that we played. Hoosier, Evanston, and so many of them, and Oak Park, and I can't remember them all, but Hoosier, but we were pretty good for 4 years. So, but then my brother, when he graduated, he was 2 years ahead of me, he married and worked at National Battle Bowl in Melrose Park there on 25th Avenue off of Lake. And that's where he worked all his life. And let's see. My brother Tony worked at American Can. And I worked there during the summers of school, potting cans and electing the boxcars. And but I grew up with five fellows that I used to pill around with all the time. We grew up just lived right close to each other. And at that time, we did a lot of things to keep ourselves busy as little kids. We used to play kick the can and all kinds of games, and I'm trying to think of some of the other games that we played, but we used to play ball, a lot of ball. We played a lot of 16-inch ball, and we had a very good team in Knowles Park, and that was one of the biggest things around here, was playing ball. And we played with the 9-inch hard ball. We didn't have any gloves at that time. You just played with your bare hands, catching that hard ball. And I remember some of the fellows were much older than I was. I played with them. I was the first baseman. And Lefty Ortenzi was a pitcher. He was well known at the time. And like I say, they're a very good pitcher with this 9-inch ball. We had a very good team, but it didn't last. We went in at 16-inch, and that's where we stayed. And there are a lot of names that I can remember. Provenessi, he was a left-hand pitcher. They had a baseball team here in Knowles Park, a hardball, regular baseball that all the pros are playing today. And he was very good. I'm surprised he didn't make the majors, but, or even the minors, but he didn't. I think he ended up with a business there on 25th, where they sold all kinds of machinery and stuff. And today I see it's gone. It's all torn down, and there's tall buildings there now. One incident I got to tell you about when I was a little kid, and Knowles Park was very good about this. They had a built like 2x10s, and they made a V out of that, and they connected it in the back, and they had horse drawn, and they plowed the snow for the people, plowed the snow on their sidewalks. And I'll never forget that as a kid. We used to watch them when they were, you know, pulling, driving the horse and pulling the sled. And another thing when I was a little kid was, I remember the a fella used to come by with his little truck, and he had crates of chickens, and he would be yelling in the middle of the street, going down the street, saying, "Galena, Galena, chickens, chickens for sale," you know. And the people would buy them, but that was kind of interesting. One of the things I remember way back when I was a little kid. Other than that, like I say, I went to high school at Proviso.
Okay.
Graduated there.
So what did you do after you graduated from Proviso?
After I graduated from Proviso, I tried to go to college twice. I went to the University of Illinois, stayed here for a week, and I was with a fellow living in a basement there. He had a job in the kitchen somewhere, so I was helping him, but he really didn't need the money because his parents had a store here in Knowles Park. I don't want to mention the names, but I thought he would help me to get a job, you know, so I could at least continue with my education, but he didn't. So I spent the whole week there living on donuts and coffee. So after a week, I finally gave up and said, "I can't do this. I can't live like this." And I couldn't get any help from home because there wasn't any money. So I came back home and went to work at Richardson. Before I did that, I ran into my coach from Proviso East. His name was Chuck Castle, and he was one of the star ends when Red Grange played football, and he played on the same team. So he wrote me a letter so I could go to the University of Iowa. And I went down to the University of Iowa with some doctor on a bus, and was introduced to the coach. Can't recall his name. I should, but I don't. But Niall Kinnick was a guy just like me, my size, only had a little more weight than I did. And he was one of their stars there. And so when I talked to I think it's Eddie, can't think of the last name of the coach, but anyway, Anderson, might be Anderson, not sure. But anyway, I talked to him, and he looked at me and said, he says, "You're a little too small, you know, you don't have the weight and everything." And So that was the end of my college try. I did go to night school a couple of times and, for different subjects, and I decided, well, I better just work. So from there, I kind of bounced around, and I was married at the time, and my wife never knew where I was working because I was all working with some outfit that the engineering place that used to send us all over to different companies to solve some of our problems in designing. Because I was a machinist, I went through that, and I also was a tool and die maker. And then when I got out of the service, I went back to the place I was working for. Was Strom Steel Ball was the name of the company, and we made ball bearings. And I really didn't even have to go into the service because I had a 1A card that told me that ball bearings were very necessary for the industry, and they needed that. And I decided, oh, I'm going into service anyway, so I enlisted in the Navy. But, and I was very happy I did that. But getting back to what I was talking about, I went to work. Well, I was bouncing around with this engineering company for quite a while. And like I said, my wife never knew where I was. And we started to have children, and we had two girls, beautiful children. And so I finally ended up at Illinois Tool in over there near Des Plaines somewhere. And I worked there for about a year. And then from there, I thought, well, I needed more money because I just bought a home. And I talked to the superintendent there, and he said, gee, Mike, he says, you're making as much as the guy that's been here 18 years, and we can't get you any more money than you're making now, and that was very little as it was. I said, well, I just have to leave then, you know. He said, well, can you stay at least a week? I said, yeah, I'll stay. So in the meantime, I had taken stuff that I had designed there and gone to Borg Warner in Bellwood, Illinois, and I was interviewed there by the sales manager, a fellow by the name of Art Welch, who was a very wonderful person. He became the CEO of BorgWarner later, and Jack Becker, the chief engineer, and Dan Gillespie, who lived in on 9th Avenue here in Maywood, I think, and one more fellow I was interviewing. I can't remember his name. But anyway, they all looked at what I had, and they were kind of amazed and says, can you start now? And I says, well, no, I have to get the company at least a week. He said, well, as soon as you finish, start. You come and work for us. So I said, yeah, and I stayed there a little over a quarter of a century. And I got a small retirement. I left that early at 62. I didn't want to stay because it wasn't worth it for the 3 years of at that time anyway. But now I wish I would have stayed. I would have worked there, but I couldn't see getting ahead for all the stuff I knew, and my background was very good in what I did. But I guess the bosses I worked for didn't quite see this, so I thought, well, I'm getting out of here, and I did. And so after I did that, I did a lot of drawing at home and monkeying around, designing different things, and I don't know if you want me to go into the rest of it.
We can maybe come back to that later on.
Okay. Yeah. I worked, like I say, for a little over 26 years at BorgWarner. Okay. I enjoyed work. I had a lot of wonderful people there that were very nice. It was a nice place to work for. It still is. They're still there. But the economy is kind of down. But I think they're doing okay, though. So there's still a lot of people working there yet. And I would advise anybody to work there because they're, like I say, they're very good.
Okay, great. Okay, let's go back to the early 1940s. Do you remember where you were when you heard about Pearl Harbor in 41?
Yeah, I think, I'm kind of guessing on this, but I'm pretty sure I went to the Aragon or the Trianon, one of those places that they were dance halls where you could go and dance with, you know, different women, girls, and I used to like to dance, so I think that's where it was when we found out that the war broke out. I was shocked because I didn't think we were going to get into it. And so, anyway, when the war did break out, it was, 1942? 41, I think it was.
December of 41.
Yeah, 41. And so I was watching all my friends being drafted, and I thought, oh, wait a while, I'm not going to get drafted. I want to choose a service I want to be in. So in fact, the only reason I kind of thought of this was way back, the fellow that was my godfather for confirmation at Mount Carmel, his name was Paul Maggio, and he was a very nice man, and when my parents were already dead, and I was around 18 or 19, and just getting out of high school, he said, why don't you join the Navy? And that's kind of stuck with me all the time. So when it came time where war broke out, I thought, well, I'm going in the Navy, because he was in the Navy. And so that's what I did. I joined the Navy and went into boot camp at Great Lakes in Camp Green Bay. We spent, I think, 3 months there, something like that, for boot camp. And
so what were some of the things that you learned in boot camp?
Well, in boot camp, that was an interesting thing. Like I said, I've never been out of Melrose Park, and joining the Navy, I'm thinking, my God, I've never been on the water in my life, you know. And, but anyway, getting back to Green Bay camp that I was in, we were about quite a few. We took one whole floor of this Camp Green Bay building, and we used to stand fire watches for at night. We were assigned duty for that, and we had to learn how to make our beds. Everything had to be no wrinkles or anything. They were kind of fussy, like I say, we had fire watch every so often. Then we had to do other details like cleaning the washrooms and all that, make sure everything was very neat. And the Navy was very strict that way. They were very clean. But that's about. We had a very good guy, chief, that was our teacher, and I got to know quite a few of the fellas, but they never came on got with the same ship that I was on. Nobody from there in that camp went on the same ship I was on. So, one thing I will say is we got all our shots for going overseas, and in order for us to get rid of the soreness from all the shots that we had for going overseas for cholera and all that stuff, that was prevalent out in those foreign countries. And they used to get us all together and say, okay, five of you, get groups of five. Now you're the last guy standing is going to be the winner. So you had to throw like a little wrestling match with these guys, and I won in my section, so I felt pretty good that way. And so I might have been a year or so older than some of the guys, you know, young kids, and so maybe that's what it was.
Plus, you were a football player.
And I was a football player at Proviso East.
Now you had a pretty good mechanical background, but you ended up being a signalman. Can you tell us how that happened?
That's a strange thing. I was a machinist where we made, God, what did we make at this company? I can't even recall. We used to take rivet machines and make them ball bearing machines. We had to convert them. And we did a lot of work doing that. And that's when after I learned quite a bit from there, I quit to get a little more money and went to work for Strom Steel Ball. That's where we made ball bearings. And it's a strange thing. It's a very good business because balls can be made almost any size you want. Like if you take a quarter of an inch, 0.250, and you want that to be a tenth or two tenths less than that size or over that size, we could do that. And they had very special machines that did that. And they used to do them by the machines used to handle these balls by the hundreds. They were fed in by feeders, and they went into a big circle like that, and then finally came out, you know, and then they tested them, and when they found the size they want, that's it, shut it off, tap the balls off. And that was very interesting. In fact, when I was at Borg Warner, where I worked, another fellow and I, Ray Satini, his name was, he was in the same group I was at Borg Warner, and we went out to a big company that took these balls and made actually bearings out of races, you know, inner race, outer race, and a separator that keeps the balls separate from each other while they're rotating these outer and inner races. I went from that. Well, from machine being a machinist, I went into a tool and die maker because I quit a job where I was making like I think $1.29 an hour, somewhere in that area, and went to a tool be a tool and die maker and start all over again in that trade for 75 cents an hour. But it paid off in the long run because I put in my time, and while I was doing that, I thought, well, gee, I got it. The die started to get bigger and bigger and bigger, and for my size, I thought, my God, I better start doing something else. So I thought, well, why don't I got to start designing? So I went to night school under the GI Bill, and I spent two years at night school, and I think my wife used to holler at me, my God, you never get out of the basement, you know, because I was constantly designing, you know, because I had I got lessons that we had to have completed when we went back the night that we had the school. So I did that for two solid years. I graduated from there with a diploma, and then I left tool and die and got a job as a designer.
Okay.
And that's how I ended up with this company with all the engineers, and we went all different places, and I decided, well, I'll go get a steady job. And I went from Illinois Tool to Borg Warner, and that's where I've been since I retired.
Okay. So then once you got back or finished with boot camp, you were assigned to a ship. How did that happen?
When I left boot camp, they assigned me into, I went to the University of Illinois to learn signalman. Now, why they made me a signalman when I was here and all this background of machinists, machinery and stuff, I could work any machine in a machine shop, and being a tool and die maker, and then the designer on top of it, and then being, I wasn't a designer at that time, I was a tool and die maker, and why they chose me to go to a signal school, I couldn't believe that. So anyway, I spent 3 months at the University of Illinois at Urbana, and learning semaphore and Morse code, and learning all the flags, because you had to know the flags, because a flag, when it's hoisted up up to the halyard on a ship, is the biggest, the fastest means of getting a signal across, because the signal doesn't go into effect until you pull the yard arm down and get that flag down. As soon as that happens, the maneuver starts. If the ship's had a zigzag, that's when they were going to do it, as soon as that you executed that, pulling that flag down. That was the fastest communication, faster than Morse code or semaphore or light or anything. That was fast, because they already had the books, the captain or whoever was in charge on the bridge, because that's where everything happened, was on the bridge where the signalmen were on a ship. And that is, I'm sure that's present today too. Although the ships are much more modern than they were back then. Anyway, we had to learn all of that at the University of Illinois. And I graduated from there as a first class seaman. And, there's a long story there. I could go on. I don't know if you want me to go on about that. But the teacher that I had was a second class petty officer as a signalman. In other words, he had two stripes on his right arm, showing that he was second class petty officer. And I'm trying to get in. I don't want to get ahead of myself. But from the University of Illinois, they sent us down to Fort Pierce, Florida, where we had a long, small boat training for landing troops into the beaches for the invasions. And so we spent a couple of months there, I'm pretty sure. It was that long, maybe a little longer than that. Then from there, we got on with they're finally going to assign us to a ship that we were going to get. So we got on a train, the whole group that went through this training, and left Fort Pierce, Florida on a train that was very, very dirty. Our clothes were filthy when we got to. We went to Brooklyn, New York to pick up the ship with that APA 47 of Lamar. And when I got there, we were assigned to that ship. And that's when we went on our shakedown cruise off of Norfolk, Virginia, in the Chesapeake Bay. And we spent, I think, about 6 days going through all these maneuvers on this ship to see if it's going to be seaworthy. And after the ship passed everything that it was supposed to pass, and being a little young kid from Melrose Park and never being on water, that was the first time I ever got seasick. Well, naturally, I'd never been on water, and the ocean was quite rough. And when I got sick, I was leaning over under the decks and heard the captain was up on top watching me and laughing at me. I said, great, thank you very much. You know? But that was the last time I got sick from being on the ocean like that, because it was pretty rough there. And I did get sick in little boat training down in Fort Pierce, Florida. And the only reason I did was because the boat I was on conked out. It died out. The engine, the diesel engine conked out and wouldn't run, and we're stuck in the water. It's very, very rough there. And I'm trying to help this young fella get the engine going again. And you know, we're getting all these diesel fumes into our system, you know, and breathing them. And oh my God, this is terrible. And I almost got sick then. And that was the last time I ever got sick. So, but I did make it, so.
Okay. Now, you mentioned earlier on the shakedown cruise that the Lamar went pretty fast at one point.
Yeah, in our shakedown cruise, we got up to 30 knots. Now, I can't really explain that. I can only explain one point. 30 knots is like 6,080 feet. Now, a mile is 5,280 feet. So that's a difference of like 800 feet more, faster than our English 5,280 feet per mile. So, but naturally that was only on our shakedown cruise to see how good the ship could, you know, how fast it could go. And, but we never did reach those speeds once we got into convoys and going into these battles or into these invasions. The most we ever traveled in was maybe the highest was 18 knots. Usually it was 10 or 12 knots, because we were constantly in convoys going to these operations. And you never went in a straight line. You constantly zigzagged. All ships zigzag. And they had they knew exactly when you had to do that, because the flags, when we had the flags, it sent that signal telling them that you had to zigzag at certain points. And that's how they did that.
Okay.
Way back then.
So why did the ships have to zigzag?
Mostly for in the case of mines or being attacked by submarine, Japanese submarines. Even though we had escorts, but they weren't that many of an escort. We had destroyers, and they weren't that many. If we had maybe five destroyers with a whole column of ships going into an invasion, that's not very many. But and not only that, I always felt that the ship I was on, the Lamar, had more firepower than some of our destroyers. Because we had 2 5-inches, one forward, one aft, and 2 twin 40s aft, and about 30-something 20-millimeter guns all over the ship. There were 6 on the bridge alone where I spent most of my time. But anyway, like I say, they constantly zigzag. The only time we went in a straight line when the war with Japan was over. Then we had running lights and everything, huh? Because otherwise you couldn't even light a cigarette, because a light could be seen all the way across the horizon, which may be 10, 12 miles out at sea. So everything was dark at night. When just before dark, darkness came, everything was black. You had to feel your way for wherever you were going.
Okay. So after your shakedown cruise was over, then the ship headed towards the Panama Canal?
Yes, we went to the Panama Canal. That's an interesting thing. I don't know if you want me to mention what I...
Yes.
The Panama Canal was started in 1888 by the French. And they gave up. They said it was impossible to do this, build that canal, because of the mosquitoes were so bad and the terrain was so bad. So they just pulled out of there. So before 1900, the United States decided that they were going to build it. And they did do this. They went through a mountain and blasted a 300 feet through this mountain, and they figured they would float the ship through this canal. And that's exactly what they ended up doing. It took 10 years for them to build this canal, and President Wilson opened it on in 1914. It was open for ships to go through the canal. And it took 100,000 men to build this canal, and it cost $375 million to do it. But the ingenuity of the American people accomplished this very hard task. And what they did send, before they started doing anything, they sent a medical team down there to get rid of all the mosquitoes. And they did accomplish this. So that's one big help that they had. They weren't being bitten to death by these mosquitoes down there. So it, but today we don't own it anymore. We turn it over to the Panama people. I don't know. I think maybe it might have been a mistake. I don't know. But it's done. So I think President Carter turned it over to them.
Okay.
But
so
it was interesting going through the canal, though, with the ship. Because we had taken aboard 1,500 Marines for our first operation. I don't know if you want me to continue.
Okay. Actually, once you got through the Panama Canal, you ended up crossing the equator?
No, the equator came quite later.
Okay.
Once we got through the canal, we headed straight to Saipan.
Okay, with those Marines.
That was where we were called back because they didn't need us. And so shortly after that, we headed to Guam, which was our first operation. And that was kind of hard because of all the coral. And the coral ran out almost 100 feet from the shore. So a lot of ships, small boats got hung up on these reefs on the coral. And they had to fight to get off of some of them, you know. But we were fortunate. We didn't get any reefs. One incident I can point out to you, though, while we were circling around, and the officer that was in charge of the boat that I was on, he says, "Well, why don't you guys jump over the side and look for mines?" I thought, this guy's got to be really something. And so we did, and I had a terrible experience. Personally, I was swimming around looking. I thought, my God, don't you grab a mine, you're like just blown to pieces, you know. And instead, when I was swimming, my hand landed on a body. It was only half of a body. I don't know if it was an American kid or Japanese or what, but that was enough. I jumped back in the boat, and that was the end of that. So, but that was an experience there. Well, we were there for a little over 5 days, I believe. And then we left from there and went back to Pearl Harbor, I believe, or Not sure.
Okay.
Just where we ended up at that,
okay.
After that.
Okay.
After Guam.
But you did participate in other invasions, such as the Philippines.
Yes, we had. We were in five invasions actually. We went to the Aniwetok. From Aniwetok, we went to the Ulithi, and from the Ulithi, we went to Leyte, the Philippines. And when we were getting there, there was a big battle going on between the U.S. warships and the Japanese ships, because we could see all the bombarding that was going on. And it was fortunate that we weren't right in the middle of that, because we didn't know that this was going to be going on. We didn't even know that there was going to be a battle there, you know. We assumed not a beach there would be, but we didn't think the warships were going to be fighting each other. But it ended up where the Americans defeated them at that point. And went into Leyte, and then Luzon, and we went in between this point. We got to the equator. Now, we were just, when I talk about the equator, when you never cross the equator, you're called a shellback. No, I called a polyglot. And the shellbacks were the people that already that were on the ship that went through through the equator. Because there's a time difference there. It's like a whole day difference. And this was really a lot of fun in one way and in a way. Well, I look at it as fun. These shellbacks, we played games on them the night before and tried to trick them, but then they got even with us the very next day, because what they do is they make a canvas circle. They sew that together, and it's about 30 feet long. And they take all the scraps from the kitchen, bones and all that, and they throw it in this big canvas thing 30 feet long. And then you had to go crawl through that, through all that garbage and get out there. But before you got through that, they had towels that were wet, and they were trying to get you on your butt, just smacking you, you know, while you're going through that. And like I say, it was a pleasure to finally get to the other end of this tube. But then they got even with us, these shellbacks. As soon as you got through the tube, they grabbed you and put you in a tank of water and start clipping all your hair off your head. And then ducking you down into the water and holding you there for a while under the water and bidding you up. And as soon as you got a breath, they push you down again. But it was a very good experience. One of the officers who was a very high in command, he wasn't the captain, but I think he was, I want to say Lieutenant J.G., but he was higher than that. He was just under a captain. And they had him with a big pack on his back, heavily loaded. He was all in uniform, and he had to go up this very, there's one spot that's a little higher than the bridge. And he had to crawl up, go up the ladders and get up on that thing and do some maneuvers up there, and then they had to come down again, and he had to go back up again. They really treated, I felt so sorry for this officer, but he did it all and went through it. But it, like I say, going through the equator was a real experience, believe me.
So what was life like aboard a ship like the Lamar day-to-day?
When we started, it wasn't so great, because the water we have for taking showers was salt water. And shortly after that, you know, it's very hard when you have soap, try to soap up in salt water, it just doesn't work. And eventually they changed to fresh water, which was a godsend, really. It was a very clean being in the Navy. I personally took showers twice a day, morning and night. It was, you know, something to do before you retired. And But a lot of times I didn't even sleep on my bunk. It was so hot. A lot of times I would get out of my bunk and just take a blanket and go and sleep on the deck under one of the boats. And I did it quite a number of times being a signalman, because I knew the boat quite well, you know, and where the bridge was and all that, and I'd be always near the bridge. But other than that, it was our uniforms had to be special. You had dungarees and a blue shirt, and they always had to be on the long sleeve. They always had to be buttoned, and you had a blue hat. But like I say, it was very clean to be on a ship, because the ship had to be clean, the decks had to be clean, and so I don't know. I was glad I wasn't in the Navy, even though we went through all this these five operations that we had. Was a big experience, and I was very glad to have served our country this way. I just wish that the VA would have done a little more for the returning veterans, because back in 1990, the Czech Congress changed something and said that we were no more going to get free health care or whatever happened to us from the VA, which was a bad thing, because I just recently went through a problem with the VA here in Hines and Maywood, and I have I don't know if it'll attach it from way back then or not, but I have a restless leg syndrome, and very difficult sleeping because your legs want to move all the time, and your wife wants to throw you out of the house. I went there, and I was getting cramps in my legs then, cramps in my legs and my fingers. Every time I worked hard, I would get cramps. And I went to my regular doctor, and he put me on quinine tablet. And now all of a sudden you can't get that anymore. And I used to cut them in quarters, and that quarter piece would make me sleep and be calm. My legs would... I wouldn't get cramps or any of that, but I can't get it anymore because the doctor said they don't make it anymore. So I thought, well, let me go to the VA. I went there one on a Saturday, and I went to the emergency room, and I was there for 2 hours, and after almost 2 hours, some nurse came and finally, and well, there were about four or five of them, and they're all sitting around. Are talking around with a magazine, and I'm looking where I'm sitting, you know, waiting for some help, and they're just shooting the breeze over there, and I'm thinking to myself, what am I doing here? I'm not getting any help, and other people are in these other little booths waiting for help, they're not getting it either, and I'm going, I can't take this, like, I'm leaving, you know, and I did that mostly because I have a wife that's three-quarters blind. She got macular degeneration in one eye and can't see out of it at all. And the other one, she can barely see out of, because she has glaucoma in it. So I thought, I can't leave my wife like this. I'm just leaving. So I went up to the desk and I said, look, I'm leaving. I said, I've been here almost 2 hours and got no help from you. So I left. I get a bill for this. So, and there was a bill for $50 or something like that. And then I kept getting bills from them for where I didn't get any service at all. So, I don't know, maybe if I shouldn't be telling you this, but it happened. So I thought, well, I'm going to go there and complain about these bills I'm getting. I didn't get any service for this. And so I did. I went to the adjutant there, and he looked at me when I told him what I'm telling you. He said, my God, he says, you don't have any bills. He said, it is zero right now. And he thanked me for coming in, and I left. And that was the end of that. So I had an appointment with, finally, I had a nurse practitioner that I was going to all the time, that wherever I went there, And she tried to help me, and I guess it was beyond her, I don't know. So I finally says, listen, how do you get a, well, she moved out of that position she was in. Now, I don't know what end she went to. And when I went there again, I said, well, as long as I can't see this nurse practitioner, how can I get to see a doctor? A doctor, so I can talk to a doctor. Well, they put me like 2 months away. And I thought, holy cats. So I couldn't make the first appointment, and I called, because you're supposed to call when you can't make your appointment. So I did. Told them I couldn't come because I think I was sick or something, or something happened to my wife. And so that made it even worse. That's when I went again, then that's when they put me two months away. And I only got to be able to go to, I go to the 5th of October. It'll be the first time I see this a doctor. So we're going to see what happens.
You're persistent.
Yes, good. I am.
Okay, so when you were on the Lamar, you were a signalman. Where were you usually stationed, being a signalman?
Was on the bridge.
Okay.
Bridge. I spent a lot of my time on the bridge.
Okay.
In fact, on the last 6 months that I was on the bridge, an incident I should tell you about. The incident we got in the somebody's invasions, and then we came back in the
Pearl Harbor.
I ran into this teacher that I had at the University of Illinois, and he had, like I say, he was a second class petty officer, and I had the same rank he had. And he was shocked when he saw me with the same rank, because he remembered me. Because I was only a seaman when I got out of the University of Illinois, which I thought I should have been at least a third class petty officer. But he didn't see it that way. But when he saw the two stripes on my arm, he was shocked. So, but anyway, getting back to on the ship, I spent most of my time on a bridge. And because we always had to have coffee for the officers. Coffee pot on the deck of the bridge was on 24 hours a day. So just to keep them, you know, satisfied. But, I'm kind of losing my thought here.
You had mentioned once before about having to climb up on a mast to rerun the line.
But anyway, before I get to that, I finally realized not where I was. About the last 6 months I was on the Lamar, I was transferred from a small boat crew into the ship's company finally, after a year or so. And the last 6 months I was the first class petty officer. I was promoted to first class. And I had 18 signalmen under my command. I was one that had to take all the responsibility. And now there was one incident that was mentioned, and I'm pretty sure this happened. One of the halyards on the yardarm, there's four lines on each side of the halyard of the line of the post that has the yardarm there with all the lines coming down, and that's where you clip your flags to haul them up, and then you haul them down to make the execution. Well, the end line broke, and I, being the man that was in charge, I didn't dare say, well, listen, you do this to one of the guys, that would be unfair to them, you know. So I, like I'll say dummy, but I wasn't really a dummy. I decided, well, Mike, it's up to you to do this, not somebody else. So I did go up the ladder, get on the yardarm, and the yardarm now is, there's a guy wire that goes to the end of the yardarm to the pole. And I had to get on, hang on to that yardarm and get on this narrow yardarm and put that line through that last line, pulley. And I was so thankful when I got through with that and it got down. I thought, my God, thank you, God, for letting me be able to do this. Because we were underway, we were not in a harbor or anything. And the ship was, you know, with the waves, you're not going really smooth. You're bouncing around a little bit. So I was scared of that, believe me. But I did do this, and I was glad I did and not had to worry about one of the guys falling. I felt, well, that was different. That was my own fault.
So you were like a couple of hundred feet above the ocean.
Oh, yeah.
Holding on with one arm.
Yes, one arm on a guy wire.
While the ship was moving at about 18 knots.
Well, maybe 10 knots, 10 or 12 knots, yes.
Okay. Now, you mentioned earlier, too, that the Lamar was actually hit by a bomb at one point during an invasion.
Oh, yes, I'll never forget this. We were going to, I can't remember if we were going to Lausanne or one of those, or Leyte, for an operation there, invasion. And I was sitting in this little well where we make the coffee. And usually when we wanted to smoke, we would go in there and close the door at night, especially. But in the daytime, it wasn't so bad. You go in there and smoke. And I was sitting in this little well where the door is, and we were underway for this operation. And at the time, we had what they call a group who they call the flag. And they were usually with an officer who was a very high man in command who ran the operation, really. And I was sitting in there, and all of a sudden, the chief from that group says, "Mike, come over here and take a light. There's a signal coming in." So as soon as I got up from there and started to walk, a bomb hit exactly almost where I was sitting. And I thought, oh, my God. And all three sailors that were manning the 30 millimeters on that particular side of the ship, because there were six of them on our ship, three on each side. Well, they were hanging from the gun strap because they got hit by the shrapnel from the bomb. And so I was very, very fortunate. I don't think I'd have been here if I was still sitting there. I would have been killed, I'm sure. But God was with me, and I guess it wasn't my time. So I went and took the message. And gave it to the chief that wanted it, and that was the end of that. But it was a horrible experience seeing these other guys, fellas, hang the way they were. And of course, they all got Purple Hearts for this, and they deserved them. One of our signalmen got hit in the leg from one of the shrapnel, and he was from one of the southern states. I can't remember. He was a second class petty officer. Very smart, because I remember I used to play checkers with him, and he used to beat me all the time. And finally, he gave me the clue as to how you beat somebody in this game. We got pretty even then after that. But it was an experience, believe me.
I'd also mentioned at one point that you saw an aircraft carrier that you thought one of your cousins was assigned to?
Yes. I had two cousins that were in the Navy also. My one cousin, Peter Impostato, he was on an LST. He was in the Coast Guard. And my other cousin, Mike Impostato, his brother, he was on a converted cruiser, which they made into a carrier for planes. And I happened to run into while we were at sea in the Pacific, I happened to spot this carrier going by, and I'm saying, "My God, that's the Clinton Bay where my cousin Mikey is on." So I right away got on the light, and I flashed, you know, because you keep flashing at the ship, and they finally sit sitting up there, I catch the flight, and I sent a message, "Please say hello to Mike Impostato for me." This is his cousin, Mike Melpierre. They're, you know, by that time now, I got the okay, that they got the message, but I never heard them because they were already gone. So, but I never did see them until when the war was over. But that's another story.
Okay, we'll get to that later. So the last operation you were on with Lamar was Okinawa?
Okinawa was the last operation. We were in there on the initial operation. Going there, we had the roughest, second the roughest seas that I've ever been in. Because at that time, there was a typhoon. And we were riding the tail end of a typhoon going into going to Okinawa. And I didn't think we would make it because being on the bridge, which is a very high point, you couldn't walk across to get from port side to starboard side. You flew across. That's how bad the seas were. We were, in fact, it leans, if it goes over 45 degrees, you're gone. And we were listing quite a bit and bouncing quite a bit. And I thought, my God, are we going to make this or not, you know? And everybody was concerned. We finally did get through it. There were some boats lost, even though they were chained to the decks. They were lost anyway because of the seas and the storm was so terrible. I never forgot that, going to Okinawa. It was one of the second roughest seas I've ever been in my life. We were lucky that the ship didn't, some of the ships didn't tip over really, and then everything is lost. So,
okay. So can you tell us much about the Okinawa landings?
I think we were in Okinawa for 5 or 6 days unloading. Because I was in ship's company now. I didn't have to worry about going into the beach with the troops. And I was kind of happy for that because I didn't have to all this worry about getting killed out there. I get killed on a ship, okay, but when you're landing, you're more at risk. And like the soldiers or the Marines, you're landing, they're putting into the beach. Now Okinawa, I didn't see. They bombarded the beach, the heavy equipment like the cruisers and the battle wagons. Any operation that you went into, the first thing that happens before you go into the beach is they get bombarded. I mean, tremendous firepower is going into all these beaches where the troops ever land, and that's a fact. I mean, it's a bombardment there. You cannot believe how anything can live. These 16-inch guns pouring these 16-inch shells into that beach and then exploding. And that happened with every operation. But one of the funniest things I ever saw was at Guam, the first operation we were in. And these ships were pounding the devil out of that beach. And when they got through and then we started, I was in small boats at that time, and the boats started to take the troops into the beaches, what happens? I see civilians come up on the shores. I couldn't believe it. You know, there weren't that many, but there were some civilians. And I thought, how could they possibly live through that? But they must have been underground, you know. But that was one of the strangest sights I've ever seen. One of the operations. But getting back to Okinawa, though, like I say, we unloaded. I don't think we fully unloaded because we had to come back and finally get rid of that stuff that we had, you know, like a lot of equipment had to go onto the beaches. And then we finally unloaded and we're left there and went back to Pearl Harbor. And shortly after that, the war was over. We were finally able to run with running lights. Finally, you can open a door with a light on, you know. Or just, at least our starboard red light was on, the green light was on the other one, port side. And, so that was a pleasure to see lights finally after the war was over with Japan. But a lot of interesting things have happened. Believe me, it was a real experience.
So after the war was over, you still had other missions for the Lamar.
Yes, Lamar, we had to go back to Corregidor, and we took many of our people that were in prison there by the Japanese. And you could see a lot of them were very thin and, you know, I can't think of the word, but they, a lot of them looked terrible because they were weren't fed properly and stuff like that. We had quite a few of them from Corregidor, and we had some of them were really bad where they had to be gone to in the where we had to go for medication and stuff.
The infirmary?
The infirmary, yeah. We had to go in there because they were, you know, so badly. They just weren't right. And but we did have quite a few of them. I think it was, you know, but a couple of hundred of them, maybe more, I'm not sure. And because we had other prisoners that we had prisoners also with us. In fact, one incident I should probably mention is we had Japanese prisoners that were one of them anyway. They were taken to lunch, and this was a solid-looking short fellow, and he decided he saw thinks he's near land, so he dove overboard from the main deck into the ocean, and we were in convoy, mind you. And this guy started swimming around, and he realized he, there's nothing, no land anywhere near him. So somebody, one of the sailors, threw a life jacket out there for him. So he put it on, swam to that jacket and put it on right away because they knew he was in trouble. And so now we're leaving him behind because he's, you know, we were like near the end of, we were the last ship in the convoy. And so we sent a message to the flagship of it for a ship ahead, and they said, well, stop and pick him up, throw line over, don't stop completely. If he reaches for the line, stop and get him. If he doesn't, continue on. Well, in the meantime, the sailor threw a ring out, life ring. Do you believe this gentleman got out of the jacket, the life jacket, and swam to the ring, and hung on to the ring to get to that line that is hanging over the ship, okay, to get back on the ship.
Wow.
And we saved his life, really, because he would have died out there. I don't know what happened after that. I mean, being way up on the bridge, he's way down the main deck, it's pretty hard. But that was kind of a funny incident that happened on our ship. We did have some burials at sea. Usually when somebody was, when it's army guys were killed or something, they usually tied a 5-inch projectile on his body and then had a board and they slid him over the tail end and they buried at sea. And,
oh, was that to weight the body down so it would sink?
So it would sink, yeah. And we got a couple of those, I think. It was sad, very sad.
Okay. So after the war was over, though, you continued in the Navy. You left the Lamar?
I finally was on there, and I was ready to get married. My wife was with you. My girlfriend was waiting for me. I got a 30-day rehabilitation leave because I hadn't been home all my time since I entered the Navy. And it was like 3 years later. And I had a rehabilitation leave, and I was married. Took a couple of weeks to get everything arranged, and was married for a week, and went on a honeymoon for that week. I was still in the Navy. I was called back, and we were at Navy Pier, believe it or not. In fact, they had bunks there and everything for the sailors, and that's where we were. And I was getting out anyway. And being a third-class petty officer with three stripes, they had me take about 75 sailors to Norfolk, Virginia to replace some of the sailors on different jobs, going to ships or whatever. And I had to carry all their records and give them to them. And And I was there for a short time, went back to Navy Pier, and lo and behold, I wasn't there long again, and gave me the same job again. I went back the second time to Norfolk, Virginia. And now I was kind of disgusted, being married for 1 week practically, and I thought, my God, when am I going to get out of here? And I was there for 6 days the second time, and I thought, God, I got to get home. Got to get back to so I can get out, because I have enough points to get out. And so I finally ran into a yeoman that was on our ship, and he was working there. And I said, I can't recall his name, though. I wish I could, but I can't. And I asked him, I said, hey, when am I going to get out of here? He said, Mike, I'll let you know. So he did. He says, you're going back to Navy Pier. So tomorrow, he says, I said, oh, thank you very much. So finally I got there, and I was finally discharged and got home. And, I was happy to see me finally.
And you had an interesting story about going home, where you were assigned to a bus. You were taking a bus home?
Oh, when I had my 30-day rehabilitation leave, I was got off in San Diego, and that was a strange thing. I just missed the plane mark, service plane, army plane, where couldn't cost me anything, but I missed it. And I thought, now how am I going to get home? So the only thing I could think of, I didn't want to get on a train. It's slow, maybe. I'll get on a bus. So I got on a Greyhound bus. And I had a fight to get a seat. The civilians were, I don't know why. I was a sailor and having my sea bag with me and everything else, and I had a fight to get on a seat, get on the bus, which was kind of strange. But I guess people are funny. So, but anyway, it did take me 72 hours to get home. And I did manage to talk to the driver that we had to drop me off at 25th and Lake. I'll never forget that. And he did manage to get me there, drop me off at 25th and Lake Street in Ellis Park, get my sea bag and all. I thanked him profusely, and he said, no, it's my pleasure. And so I walked home then. I was just short way from my home. So that was how I got home.
So then you were finally discharged in January of 46?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just a little over, almost 3 years. I was in 3 years. Because I was in January, and I got out in 43. I went in, and I got out in 46. So it was 3 years. Okay. It was a good life, believe me. If I wasn't getting married, I probably would have re-enlisted. I would have been a chief then, maybe made it my life, but I decided not to. I just wanted to get home, and I thought I had enough. And then we had we had a different captain, but the captain that we had, the name of B.K. Culver, a very strict man. He knew the service very well. He was in it for a long time, and in fact, there was a story that went around back then that he was on a cruiser before he ever got this ship, Lamar. And the story goes that they sighted the Japanese coming into Pearl Harbor, way out at sea. They didn't know exactly where they were heading, but they were going to Pearl Harbor. But they were told, this is a story now, and I don't know how true it is, they were told to keep radio silence. And then Pearl Harbor happened. So now, how true the story is, I haven't know. I have no idea. All I know, it was scuttlebutt maybe. But anyway, we did get this man that was an executive officer on that cruiser, and he became the captain on our ship, U.S. Lamar. And like I say, it's...
That'd be interesting if it was true.
Yes, it would be. But I don't know how true it was. I don't know if it was meant to be or what. I don't know.
Fate,
yes.
So, okay. Do you have any other stories you'd like to share with us today? Or? Any closing thoughts?
Well, I'm very happy that you people asked me. I hope I satisfied what you're looking for.
Now this is your interview, so whatever you want to say.
I'm thankful to be alive and back. The war was hell. War is always our hell. There's no nobody gains in a war. It's always a loss. I probably shouldn't say this, but I'm going to say it anyway. I did not agree with President Truman doing what he did to General MacArthur. General MacArthur was one of the smartest person that ever came out of from West Point, I believe. He was a very brilliant general. Had he gone and did what he wanted to do, go up the Yellow River and up there near China, maybe a lot of stuff wouldn't have happened. But they denied him to do that, and then they were captured. And the other thing I disagree with, that bombing the Japanese like he did. They said, yeah, it saved a lot of American lives, but the Japanese, I think, were finished anyway, even though they had a lot of stuff that they were going to throw at us if we would have attacked Japan, which would have been next for sure. But bombing those people and killing all those innocent people, I think, was wrong. It put us in the same category that Hitler was in. But that's only my personal thought. I don't think it should have been done. Those people were innocent enough, even though they were our enemies. I don't think they should have been killed like that. And just like what Hitler did with the Jews, it wasn't right. So, but he was the president, and he made the decision to do it. So there was nothing I could do. But I personally disagree with that decision.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming in today and sharing your memories with us. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.